Talk to us now and go to the TNT Radio Interactive Live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT. Discussing national and international issues. This is the David Curtin Show on today's News Talk, TNT.
Hello and welcome to the David Curtin Show here on today's News Talk TNT. And it's a very, very important day today because the ruling is going to be given in the Julian Assange case, which TNT exclusively covered in the UK. None of the other media outlets were interested when the hearing took place about a month ago. Now, Taylor Hudak is going to be here with me later in the show to discuss that. And we'll look at that in more detail then about 20 past the hour. But yesterday, a report was released in the UK concerning the dire state of the energy situation in the country. This was a report by Offshore Energies UK, and it says that we now import 40% of the oil and gas that we need to use, and 11% of the electricity that we need to use is imported in undersea cables coming mostly from France and the Netherlands. This is an absolutely shocking state of affairs, given that the United Kingdom is an island which is founded upon coal and it's surrounded by oil and gas in the North Sea. We should be energy self-sufficient, but we're not because of the idiocy of climate alarmism, which is being pushed by all of the parties in Parliament, which have been there but for a long time but don't deserve to be there, the fake Conservatives and Labour, who have ruled one after the other for a number of decades, as long as I can remember. What the report says is that energy production has decreased in the UK by two-thirds since the year 2000, just in a very short space of time, 24 years. The demand for energy has gone down in the UK over the same period of time by a third, but the production has gone down even more than the demand. Now, the fact that demand has gone down is no cause for celebration, because the reason why demand for energy has gone down is because we have decimated our manufacturing sector and outsourced our manufacturing industry in almost every area to countries like China and Indonesia and Bangladesh and so on. So we're left with very, very little good manufacturing industry. We heard last month that Tata Steel, an Indian company that owns the steelworks in Port Talbot in South Wales, is closing down the blast furnaces and just going to go to an operation where it recycles steel. So for the first time since the Industrial Revolution, the nation where the Industrial Revolution started in the 18th century does not have the capacity to produce its own high-quality steel. That is an indictment on our industrial policy and our energy policy. And it's been done because some bean counters somewhere in government who are adherent to the nonsense of climate alarmism think this is a good thing because we're going to use less carbon and we're going to produce carbon dioxide, as though carbon dioxide is some kind of harmful gas when it's not. Anyone who works in agriculture and horticulture can tell you that they increase the levels of carbon dioxide in greenhouses and glasshouses to way, way above what is there in the atmosphere, so that fruits and plants grow quicker and we get bigger and juicier fruit to eat, which sustains us in our supermarkets. Now, since 2014, this current government has decimated our coal production. There were 14 coal power stations in 2014 producing 40% of the energy that we need for our electricity generation. Those have almost all been closed. There's only three left, and they're all due to close by 2025. Indeed, one of the government ministers actually posed in front of a power station in Ferrybridge in West Yorkshire, pressed a button and demolished it. And he said, and he was smiling like a Cheshire cat, as though he'd done some good thing, when actually that was just a symbol of how they are destroying our energy infrastructure. Now, the
alternatives which are being created to make up the shortfall by destroying the capacity to produce energy from carbon-based fuels are not worth the paper that the money that is given to them, and they don't produce any energy at all when the wind stops blowing, and very little when the sun stops shining. And they could cause all kinds of terrible environmental issues where they are put in. Solar farms, for example, are unwanted by anybody who lives in the country. Just last week, we heard that there are plans to create a 4-square-mile solar farm, the biggest of its kind in the UK, in rural Wiltshire on prime agricultural land, decimating the farmland and whatever agricultural industry goes on there. And again, it's not going to produce much energy. Another insane thing, if you think that solar and wind are bad enough, the current policy du jour is to build battery energy storage systems all around the country. And these are spoken of and talked up as though they are going to be the solution to our energy crisis, because they will be able to generate 30 gigawatts of energy by 2030, which would keep us going on a summer's day. The thing is, though, they don't produce their own energy. It has to be created somewhere else by a carbon-based energy power station. And they also don't have enough energy stored to keep the country going for very long at all. At the moment, we have 2.4 gigawatts of battery storage systems. That's the power rating, with 2.6 gigawatt hours of energy stored in them. If you do a quick calculation, that tells you that all the battery energy storage systems we have in the country at the moment will run out of energy in precisely 1 hour and 3 minutes. It's not going to keep the country going at all. We need to get back to reliable and continuous energy: coal, oil, nuclear, and gas. Any government or any agency or NGO that tells you difference is deceiving you. And I wonder if they're related to a lot of people who are making an awful lot of money by putting up infrastructure which isn't going to provide our energy and is going to cause blackouts in the future in the United Kingdom. This is today's News Talk, TNT.
Bringing you a world view.
I like to hear what's going on around the world.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the David Curtin Show here on today's News Talk TNT. Gemma Cooper is here as always. Welcome to the show, Gemma. And can you tell us what's going on in the UK today?
Well, just before I get to some UK headlines, you know, this is my role, is to bring the latest headlines and analysis from the UK. But of course, we're seeing those extraordinary scenes of the bridge in Baltimore that's completely collapsed in America, you know, after being allegedly hit by a ship, I think it is. I mean, just extraordinary images, you know, breaking news. I know it's not the UK, but we very rarely see things like that. They're just massively extraordinary scenes of this, you know, massive bridge just falling into the river. It's quite really extraordinary footage. And there are casualties now. Big rescue operation is underway. You know, these headlines are going around the world. And I just thought we must at least acknowledge that we understand breaking news. We understand the significance of this particular story, because they're not supposed to do that. Bridges are supposed to be able to withstand and sustain collisions. So yeah, it really quite a big developing story. UK wise, there's a lot going on today, as you've just said, about Julian Assange. I mean, he finds out in just over an hour's time. Him and his legal team will find out about whether he's won his right to appeal his extradition against his extradition hearing. Campaigners and supporters gathering outside the High Court in London, much as they were last month for the hearing itself, the original hearing itself. Also, sticking with Westminster, we've seen a big farmers' protest outside the Houses of Parliament. Tractors came from all over the UK and brought the roads to a standstill. UK farmers, biggest protest we've seen from the UK farmers against cheap imports and other regulations, which they are saying is driving them into the ground, much like farmers across the rest of the world, lockstep. The Home Office today has announced it's launched an investigation into border control staff at Manchester Airport. They allegedly targeted two Israeli brothers flying into the UK only because they were Israeli. There have been cries of anti-Semitism thrown against the border control staff, and the Jewish Representative Council of Britain has criticised them, and the Home Secretary has today said an investigation has been launched. And the legacy of the Kate Middleton story, doctors and scientists around the world say they're struggling to find why so many people under 50 now are coming to them with cancers. There's an explosion in cancers under people with people under the age of 50, and scientists say they cannot find the reason why.
I wonder what the reason why is. I think we all know what the reason is there. It doesn't need to be said, does it? Also, you know, you mentioned so many things there of interest. I mean, that bridge in Baltimore, I know it's not in the UK, but it's very, very big and significant bridge. I mean, it would be like, you imagine if the Fourth Bridge or the Menai Bridge had been hit by a ship and then had collapsed into the sea. I mean, it's that stunning to look at. And obviously, it's going to cause a horrendous disruption to the people in the area. But Gemma, I'll come back to that story about the border force, and an investigation has been started into what happened in Manchester Airport. Now, this seems like quite a random incident that happened. The investigation, you know, has obviously got to come to its conclusions. But do we know anything more about the actual conversation that happened there in Manchester Airport?
Yeah, well, the Jewish Representative Council of Great Britain has issued a statement. They put it initially on X, and James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, responded on X and said, yeah, we are investigating this. So the pair flew in on March the 24th. They were survivors of the Hamas attack at the music festival on October the 7th, and they also helped rescue other people there, according to the Jewish Representative Council. Both of them had PTSD, and they were coming to the UK to talk about their experiences and raise awareness of a non-profit organisation they founded to help people from terror attacks. Now, allegedly, they got off the plane and Border Patrol saw their Israeli passports and immediately said, right, we're questioning you. We're taking you in. And they were questioned for 2 hours. And allegedly, again, this is according to the Jewish Representative Council, the Border Control staff said to them, we need to make sure you're not going to do what you're doing in Gaza over here, implying because they were Israeli, they were going to, you know, start targeting Muslims effectively, or you know, killing people, really. That's what they were saying. Obviously anti-Semitism is the accusation, that they only targeted these people because they were Israeli. There was no basis, there was no intelligence that was suggesting they were coming over to commit atrocities. They were coming over to speak. Manchester Airport has said that these staff are employed by UK Border Control. That is a Home Office department. They're not employed by the airport themselves. It's a completely separate authority that works within the airport, checking passports as they come in. Border Control itself has come in for some criticism over recent weeks. I've covered that story before. But here, have they been heavy-handed? Were they being overcautious? You know, the statement, which is quite, you know, we have to make sure you're not going to do over here what you do in Gaza. I mean, that really is, they're not IDF. You know, or is that what they thought that they were, you know, Israeli Defence Force people because they had Israeli passports? But certainly the Home Office has said, we're investigating this. We will not tolerate anti-Semitism or attitudes that like this. But the Home Office has also said, until they establish the facts of this one, they're not commenting any further. I think it's an example here, David, of how when you've got a big global event like what's happening in the Middle East, that those tensions, as we've seen on the streets of London, they filter down to a more local level. That's where you get incidents like this, because people get very heightened. It's very divisive. It raises emotions. And therefore, you get these one-on-one interactions, which are a microcosm of what's happening globally.
Well, of course, the key question here is, who were the Border Force staff? And, you know, are they connected to the Palestinian movement or, you know, Palestinian resistance or anything? Way, are they pro-Palestinian supporters? Do they go out on the march? Are they very, very heavily involved in supporting and, you know, taking one side or the other? And is that spilling over into their work in the border force? I think, you know, we can all ask the question, you know, were they, let's go there, were they Anglo-Saxons? Were they white Anglo-Saxons? Saxons, or were they some other ethnic identity? And did that affect how they were treating these Israeli people? You know, obviously this does come into it, and maybe that's a question that you wouldn't get asked in the mainstream media, but it's a question that maybe they are going to investigate in when they look into this.
You know, David, you took the words out of my mouth, because as I was researching this story before coming on air, I did think that. I thought, what were the allegiances of the people at border control? Because, you know, we're all told to have no bias, no prejudice when we're doing professional roles, but everyone holds views. What were the personal views of the people? Why did they go so heavy-handed? What allegiances did they have? Of course, they're questions that will need to be asked. I very much doubt, like you, whether the mainstream will ask that. We would hope that the investigation by the Home Office, by the Home Secretary, will also ask those questions. That is the question. Why did they feel the need to go so heavy? And, you know, obviously the Jewish Representative Council has weighed in on this very, very quickly, wants answers, and let's see what type of answers we get. I don't have any detail at all on who the Border Patrol security were. There's no detail being released about them. You know, we don't know that even if they're men or women or anything like that. We just know there's an investigation being carried out. But yeah, that's the question. It might be a question that leads to a dead end. We don't know, but it is a question that needs to be asked.
It's a question that if you ask it, you sometimes get called a racist just for asking the question. And maybe, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if any report there would just whitewash it out, because we do have two-tier policing and two-tier justice in this country. We've seen that very clearly in many events, but over the past few years. But let's hope that they do ask the question, and that not just these two Israelis get treated fairly when they come into the country, but everybody from all over the world gets treated fairly and is subject to equality, real equality under the law, when they come into the country and when they're here as well. Well, there we go, Gemma. Thank you so much for bringing those stories to us. This is today's News Talk, TNT.
TNT's James Freeman.
Now that I'm sitting on the other side of the fence, I see the budget in a very different light. I find the discussions and leaks in the press in the weeks running up to the budget totally patronising. You know, will he, won't he give us some tax cuts? When the reality is that nothing in the budget will make any material difference to anyone. Pretty much, that's usually the story. It is a game of musical chairs where the government giveth with one hand and taketh with the other. And we're all reminded about how little money that we've got left in our pockets.
James Freeman on today's News Talk, TNT. If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the David Curtin Show here on today's News Talk, TNT. And it's fantastic to have with me on the line today Taylor Hudak, who is an American Hungarian journalist based in Budapest and has a wonderful resume. You do so much stuff, Taylor. You write for The Last American Vagabond. You're involved in Children's Health Defense Europe and Doctors for COVID Ethics. All really good stuff, questioning all the narratives that we get coming at us all the time from governments and the mainstream media. Anyway, Taylor, welcome to the show. Really good to have you with me.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
That's great. Now, one of the things that you have been talking about, that we have been talking about here on TNT, is the Julian Assange case. And this is a big day. When we heard yesterday, an announcement is going to be made at 10:30 UK time. So that's only about an hour away from when we're doing the show live here. What are you feeling at the moment about what might be said when the outcome of the case is released?
Well, you know what? I will say I'm feeling quite optimistic. And I was feeling optimistic back in February last month, during this two-day permission to appeal hearing. I covered this along with a handful of other journalists, and I have to say I was sitting there in the courtroom for both days, and the defense representing Julian Assange had such a strong case. And again, they were arguing for Mr. Assange to be granted the opportunity to appeal once more before the UK courts domestically in order to prevent his extradition to the United States. So today, this decision, which as you said, is coming up in just 1 hour, so very soon here, this decision is very important. These two judges are going to make us aware if Mr. Assange has that opportunity to appeal or if he begins to enter the extradition process to the United States. And for all of those who care about press freedom and free speech, of course, hope that he has one more opportunity to appeal. So this is a very important moment in this case today.
It certainly is, because everyone can see the injustice of this. He is just a journalist and he's done nothing wrong. And he hasn't even said anything incorrect, has he? Everything he said has been absolutely true. And he has put the finger and pointed the finger and shown wrongdoings in the government, particularly the US government and the US military, hasn't he?
That's exactly right. WikiLeaks has a 100% accuracy rate in its reporting. That is the work, of course, of Julian Assange. And the work that he has done through WikiLeaks won him numerous journalism awards. And it's this very work that he is being prosecuted for. And if you look at the facts of this case here, you'll see that the work of WikiLeaks was able to really show to the world crimes being done on behalf of the US government. And you see that this really made a positive change in our world. But I do want to go back to the facts of the case here. What they were able to show and really spell out during this hearing back in February was that the defense made a very strong point stating that the prosecution is relying on the US-UK extradition treaty to prosecute Assange, but they ignore a very important safeguard and protection within the treaty, which is Article 4, that one cannot be extradited from the UK to the United States for political offenses. And remember, Mr. Assange is being charged with espionage. That's inherently political. It has always been recognized by the leading authorities in the law textbooks as being a political offense. That is espionage. So right then and there, this extradition should be prevented on that ground alone, let alone the numerous other strong points that are in the favor of Mr. Assange, in addition to the fact that the, remember, original judge back in January of 2021 blocked the extradition. Her decision was that it would be oppressive to extradite Mr. Assange under Section 91 of the UK Extradition Act of 2003, and then the decision got overturned. So I always remind people that it was the initial judge, the magistrate's judge, actually ruled against his extradition. So this has really been a punishment by process for Mr. Assange. Again, he is still in Belmarsh prison.
Yeah, you're right. It's like the process is the punishment, isn't it? He's been there for really nearly 5 years now in this horrible place, Belmarsh Prison. It is our high security prison, the highest security prison in the UK, where terrorists and mass murderers go. There's no chance of escape. It's on an already depressing area of Southeast London. And when you go behind the prison walls, it's even more depressing as well. What do you think is making the American authorities pursue this, even though the judge in the hearing beforehand said that he shouldn't be extradited? They seem hell-bent on just pushing this as far as they possibly can and try to get him to go to America. Why are they picking on this one man, but then seemingly, you know, ignoring other cases where you think that there was much more of a reason to bring someone to court?
Yes, exactly. It appears very much that they are trying to make an example of Mr. Assange, and that they are also trying to set a precedent, a global precedent, where national security journalism and normal journalistic activity will then become a crime. And in fact, during the previous hearing, In February, the defense stated in court that this is a prosecution in retaliation ordered from the very top, meaning the very top and the highest levels of the U.S. government. The listeners will remember, who I'm sure they've been, you know, following this case, they'll remember that the CIA, the U.S. intelligence services, actually attempted to assassinate Mr. Assange while he was seeking asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. So this is a man that they have been persecuting and prosecuting for quite some time now. And we're hopeful that these two judges that will issue their decision today, that they are going to be able to see that he deserves another chance to be able to appeal, and that he is not going to be safe if extradited to the United States. I mean, this has been laid out very clearly. And again, it goes back to the original decision. The judge felt that he would be at risk, that it would be oppressive to extradite him to the United States. And you have to look at it very simply. The UK courts at this point are stating that it is acceptable to extradite a man to a country whose very intelligence agencies conspired to assassinate him. That is how serious of an issue this is. And again, it's not just about journalists or activists. This case will impact the public's right to know and access information.
Yeah, well, don't go away, Taylor. We're going to come back after this quick news break and talk more about the Julian Assange case. Obviously, the hearing and the outcome of the hearing is going to be announced very, very shortly in just an hour's time. This is today's News Talk, TNT.
TNT Radio News. Bring the news. 5, 4, 3, 2.
Matt Boyland here with your TNT headlines. Russian President Vladimir Putin says Friday's terrorist attack in Moscow was carried out by radical Islamists, but he says he's more interested in finding out who gave them the order. The divide between the US and Israel is deepening after Washington refused to block a UN Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. And farmers have rolled up to London in their tractors protesting against ludicrous climate policies, which they say are hurting their bottom lines.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the David Curtin Show here on today's News Talk, TNT. And Taylor Hudak is still with me, a journalist who was in the courtroom in the hearing of Julian Assange just a month ago. The ruling is going to be announced later. Taylor, one thing that really concerns me about this process of trying to extradite Julian Assange to the USA is that the US government seems to think that it has global jurisdiction. So here's an Australian who said something on the internet. He wasn't in the United States. He was in the UK. He was also in Iceland and various other countries. But the US seems to think that it can control and manipulate the justice systems of any country in the world. And that is a very frightening thing, isn't it?
Oh, it absolutely is. It's so important for people to remember this important point, and that is that Julian Assange is not an American citizen. He is an Australian citizen. At the time that he was publishing this information, he was not in the U.S. jurisdiction, yet he is still being charged under the U.S. Espionage Act, which, by the way, this is an unprecedented case. There has never been a case in which a journalist has been prosecuted under the Espionage Act for publishing information. Historically, it has always been seen that the Espionage Act was not to be used against innocent citizens for political purposes. And that's exactly what's happening here. And this was, again, a strong point that was brought up by the defense during the hearing back in February. But then again, it also brings up another issue, which is that because Mr. Assange is an Australian citizen, he's a foreign national, he would quite possibly not be given First Amendment protections, which puts him at a great risk of not having a fair trial. Of course, in the United States, we have the First Amendment, in which there's a freedom of the press and free speech. However, those rights will not be afforded to him, or it's perceived that those rights will not be afforded to him. And this is, I think, a very strong point. And I do think
that if an appeal hearing is allowed, I think it will be on this issue, that ground regarding the First Amendment issue, and then also regarding this issue of the death penalty. Because what could happen, again, what could happen is that if extradited to the United States, Mr. Assange could face additional charges once on U.S. soil. Let's say, for example, perhaps treason, which does potentially carry the risk of the death penalty. And under the U.S.-UK extradition treaty, one cannot be extradited if they face the death penalty. So this was an important point that was brought up during court, that the prosecution was unable to make it clear and to make certain that he would not face the death penalty once extradited. So I think on these two points, the First Amendment point and the death penalty point, if there is an appeal, I suspect it may be on those two grounds, hopefully others as well, because there's some other strong grounds for appeal as well. But these were two points that I could tell both of these judges during the hearing were very laser focused on and very interested to hear a little bit more. And they were questioning the prosecution on these two points in particular.
Well, that sounds very hopeful. And, you know, I've lost a lot of faith in the British justice system, particularly over the last 4 years, where we've had, you know, not just Julian Assange being in prison, but we've had lockdowns and we've had huge fines for people who have organized rallies, and they've been targeting innocent people just going about their daily business. And we seem to have a system of two-tier justice where if you're deemed someone who the state doesn't like and they don't like what you say, you seem to be more of a target to the police and the justice system than people who commit actual crimes like assault or vandalism. And so, you know, this doesn't make me have much faith in the judges that we've got. So it's actually very comforting and optimistic to hear you say that, and to hear that they are seemingly looking into everything, you know, with a fair mind. You know, that's a good thing. But there's one thing that I would like to ask you about, and that is a question about President Trump. As a lot of people thought, he would have pardoned Julian Assange at the end of his first term of office in 2020, because he was very, very positive about WikiLeaks back in 2016, but he didn't. Do you know anything about that, or, you know, the possible reasons why he changed his mind, you know, and the messages he was giving out over the 4 years he was in office?
Right. Well, if you look, well, here, I'll start with this. Many of us, of course, were hopeful that former President Trump would issue a pardon to Assange. I do think it was sort of a long shot, but of course there were many efforts to try to encourage him to do so. Unfortunately, he did not. But if you take a look at who President Trump surrounded himself with, it does make sense. He surrounded himself with people like Mike Pompeo, who, while he was the CIA director in 2017, referred to WikiLeaks and Julian Assange as a non-state hostile intelligence agency. So if President Trump was surrounding himself with people who have this attitude toward WikiLeaks, it's no wonder why he chose not to issue a pardon. Also, I think that many presidential candidates are going to have some difficulty going up against their own intelligence agencies when it comes to pardoning Assange. I'm very hopeful, though, that the United States will drop the charges altogether. I mean, that would be the best outcome. And in fact, it's very interesting that there's legislation being proposed, bipartisan legislation, in fact, in the United States, calling for the U.S. Department of Justice to drop the case and to drop these charges. And you have people of all sides of the political, or both sides of the political spectrum, advocating for this bill, from Marjorie Taylor Greene, who's very conservative, to members of the squad like AOC and others. So it's very interesting that when it comes to dropping the case against Julian Assange, you have people on both sides of the political spectrum who are usually quite at odds actually agreeing on this very issue. So I think it's time that the United States realizes that each day, and I said this back several years ago, and it's so true still today, each day that Julian Assange remains in Belmarsh prison is just one more day that the United States betrays its own principles and betrays its own constitution and its own First Amendment.
Mm. every day there's more and more awareness of what's going on here and more support for him. And more people are speaking out because they see the injustice of this. And this is a brazen attack on free speech of just someone who is an ordinary citizen who is telling the truth and not doing anything wrong. And, you know, that's a good thing, even though he's still holed up in Belmarsh there. I really hope he is not extradited. But there is one final question I'd like to ask, because there are some reports around today or this week that say what might happen is the American government or the people in court, they might offer a plea bargain that would say if he pleads guilty to a lesser charge of mishandling classified material, they might let him, the 5 years he's served in Belmarsh, they might let that count as a sentence that's already been served if he pleads guilty to this lesser charge. Is there any truth in that? Is there any veracity in that?
Yes, I saw these reports as well. It's very interesting. And I'm not sure if today's judgment is related to this potential plea. That would be very interesting. And that would, you could argue, would be best case scenario, because then it would be seen as time served. And I believe that would offer a pathway for the domestic or all of the legal proceedings to be dropped, which would be a great victory for Mr. Mm-hmm. Assange. Again, he would have to plead guilty to that lesser charge, which of course is not preferred, but it's a plea deal. Now, I did see also reports that one of the U.S. attorneys, Barry Pollock, said that it was inappropriate for him to comment on the matter, but that he did not have any indication that there was any discussion with the U.S. authorities about a potential plea. But again, I also thought to myself, well, it could be that this is something that they want to keep private and out of the public eye if they're having this negotiation. So we will see very soon here, just under an hour, we'll be receiving that decision. So I'll stay on top of it. And yes, we're hoping for the best here for free speech and a free press for us all.
Absolutely, we are. Let's hope for the right outcome in a few minutes' time. Taylor, thank you so much for joining me on the show to discuss this very, very important case. This is today's News Talk, TNT.
When a crisis hits, close to home and across the globe, nonprofits are on the front lines, ready to serve.
Keep coming.
The demand for charitable services has skyrocketed, and nonprofits are rising to meet the needs. Healing. Nurturing. Rescuing. Honoring. Protecting. Caring. Inspiring. The work of philanthropic organizations of all sizes, across all missions, has never been more important. And it's donors and volunteers like you who make all this possible. Thank you. Together, we change the world. The Nonprofit Alliance.
Need a ride?
Yeah!
Driving with kids is a big responsibility.
Hop in and buckle up!
So don't sweat the small stuff.
You got paint all over our paper!
Get the big stuff right instead.
What does that mean?
Like making sure your kids are in the correct car seat and buckled up for safer travel.
That deserves a wiggly wiggly wig.
To make sure your child is in the right seat for their age and size, visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Discussing national and international issues, this is the David Curtin Show on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the David Curtin Show here on today's News Talk, TNT. And it's really good to have back on the show Dr. Neil McRae. Welcome to the show, Neil.
Hello again, David. Good to be back on your show. How's it going?
It's going really well, thank you, Neil. Like, this is my seventh week of the show, so it's like I've just settled into it. I had a lot of trepidation in the first week because I was like stepping up and being a host rather than a guest. But here we are, and you came on the show in my very first week, and it was a really great interview. And now you're back again, and we got so much to talk about. And you wrote an article recently, which is about cash. It's called "Use It it or lose it, the global battle to keep cash. And we are really in a battle. I never thought that I would see the sort of conveniences of cards and the things that we have lead to the place where outlets all over the country are now stopping taking cash. What do you make of this all?
Well, I remember about 10 to 15 years ago now, getting irritated when I was in a pub and somebody was trying to pay by card. Because back sort of 15 years ago, you didn't have the, the contactless payments. And it just seemed to me to be people causing unnecessary delay. You know, why can't you just bring money out with you when you come to the pub? Yes. And now it's a norm in many pubs. Some bars don't even take cash now. And even the ones that do, they kind of thrust the card transaction machine under your nose. I always use cash, and I think that people have got to realize, they've got to wake up to the fact that convenience may be attractive in the short term, but the way this is going is not really for ordinary people's benefit at all. This is so that we can be completely tracked, and cash will become, once it's fully digital, it will become programmable. So you won't be able to make purchases, or you'll have rationing. You have limits on what you're allowed to spend on certain things. So I think it is really very, very important to get the message across to people that cash is freedom. The more of us that use cash, the harder it is for the authorities to impose a complete digital currency system.
Yeah, we saw that a little bit in the lockdowns, didn't we? It's like you had to have, it wasn't cash as so much. It wasn't a wallet, a central bank digital currency wallet, but it was a vaccine wallet, and you weren't allowed into certain shops and into certain venues and bars, even pubs, if you didn't have proof of vaccine status or test status. And that meant that you couldn't use cash either. But once you got in there, they wouldn't take cash either. So they had a double whammy. First of all, you had to prove some medical status to get into a venue. And when you got in the venue, they said cash is dirty. We can't take it because it might be diseased. It might have virus particles on it. So you can only use your card. That was a real attack on our freedom, wasn't it?
And it's still going on, David. I mean, that article that I wrote last week on the Conservative Woman website featured an exchange with a local friend of mine who is very involved in the campaign to keep cash. And whenever he goes to a business, a restaurant, for example, that refuses cash, he always writes a letter to the head office. And there's a restaurant chain called Cote, French style restaurant chain.
I know it.
And they replied with the rationale as if we're still in 2020 or 2021, saying that customers don't like cash because it's unhygienic. It could be carrying COVID-19 or other germs. This, of course, is absolute nonsense. But you and I know, David, that the real reason is it's got nothing to do with preventing contagion. It's that there's this mad dash to try and get people in this digital trap before too many people wake up.
You're right. It's absolute nonsense, isn't it? Because they were saying in 2020, they're still saying it now, like some of these chains you mentioned, oh, cash is dirty. But then people who are using their hands to touch notes, well, they would still touch their cards, they would touch the table, they'd touch the knives and the plates and the goods that they're taking off the shelves and taking to the counter. So, you know, if you want to stop, like, any people from touching anything, you've got to actually ban people, not cash, which may be what some people want to do. I mean, I think there are some crazy people who actually want to get rid of all the useless eaters, as they call us, in the world. But in the meantime, as you say, they want to introduce the central bank digital currency, which is quite frightening, a thought. And that would be tied to something like we have in China, perhaps, with this social credit system. Do you think there's any chance of a social credit system being introduced here as well?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I believe that China, over the decade since Chairman Mao, the communists, took over, I believe it's been used as a laboratory, really, for a totalitarian collectivist system. And I think that's only accelerated since Mao's death in 1976. The so-called modernization of China is really just about the application of digital technology to impose a totalitarian surveillance state in China, where they have the social credit system up and running. But look, that is just a testing ground for the way that the globalists want us all to live in that kind of system. And one of my big concerns, I know it's a concern of yours as well, David, is our politicians, our political representatives, what are they doing to defend us from these impositions? I remember you doing a video in when you were in Bognor Regis of, I think it was a NatWest Bank that was closing down. You were there on its last day and looking at the posters on the window. And it's quite shocking when that happens to a local community, when they lose their bank. And if there's no banks, David, it's hard to get cash. I mean, you've still got some cash machines outside supermarkets, but, you know, for how long? In Bexhill, for example, where I live, you know, I made the sort of slightly jokey remark that every day is a bank holiday in Bexhill because all bank branches have closed. Now, where are the local MPs? Why aren't our political representatives making a song and dance about this? But they're not, because they seem to all be tuned to the whole sort of UN agenda, which is about making everything synthetic and contactless and digital. Really, our MPs should be up in arms about this. You know, Bexhill, where I live, has got a large elderly population. People like to use cash. People like to go about things in the way they've always lived. And they like to have a bank to help them out with things that you can't get done on internet banking. So I think this is another illustration of how our political representatives are not working for us anymore. That they're working for the globalist technocratic elite.
Yeah, I remember making that video that you mentioned in Bognor Regis, which is, you know, the other side of Sussex to Bexhill. Seems the two towns there and towns all around the country are having the same issue. I remember the day Barclays closed, NatWest was closing a few weeks later, meaning that, you know, Bognor still has two banks, but how long they're going to last, I don't know. Bexhill is a town of, what, 50,000 or so people? And without a bank, you have to go to another town, or they're saying, oh, you can still have banking services, but at the post office. But if you do the maths, you see all these banks are closing and then everybody has to go to the post office. So the queues now to get any service at the post office are like horrendous. You've got to wait so long to actually see someone. And it's really hard for an ordinary person, but it's even harder for a business if you want to get cash and pay cash in and take cash out. It's just very, very difficult to do. So I think the MPs,
And another thing that's happened, David, is that post offices themselves have been closing, so that many towns now they don't have the traditional main sort of post office building. Mm. A lot of them are moved inside a W.H. Smith's branch. And so you go into some smaller towns where there's a W.H. Smith now, and there's just big queues snaking around the aisles selling like stationery and other products. So the whole system, they don't want physical contact. They want to atomize us. They want to get us all doing everything digital and never leaving our homes.
It's like coercion, isn't it? Because they make life so difficult to use cash that then people just try to find another way to do it, because otherwise they're going to waste an hour of their day every day in a queue, and you'd rather do that, use that time to do something more worthwhile. But you know, that's one thing. Another thing are the supermarkets and so on. Like most supermarkets you go into, even down to the small chains at co-ops and things like this, are now bringing in personless tills, self-service. So you go in and you scan the items yourself, and they're usually card only, so you can't use cash in them. And then they've also got surveillance cameras looking at you, and or you know, you wonder if they're doing some kind of facial recognition when you're forced to go to a machine to pay for your goods, and that cuts out the person that might be the only person in the day that you speak to, if you're, you know, maybe an older person or someone, something like that.
Well, that's right. Now, what younger people, because the younger generations are the ones that have been totally brought up in the digital culture, whereas like so you and me, David, we're what they call digital immigrants, i.e. we lived in a different system before, and we've now got used to living in the digital world, but we still do things wherever we can. In the analog world, younger people do everything digital. What we've got to try and get across to them is that anything that's digital isn't private, it's known. So if you go and take a basket of food products from the shelves in your local Morrison's supermarket, for example, and you pay in cash, no one in government or anywhere else knows what you bought, because you're nameless. You're an anonymous customer. And when you get your bank statements, that none of those purchases appear on it, because you paid in cash. You've had total freedom and privacy. Whereas anyone using those machines, automated tills, they call them self-service, David, but that's an oxymoron, because, you know, service is something you get from someone else. You don't serve yourself, you know. But anyway, not only do you pay by card at those automated tills, but as you say, there's cameras as well, because there's a serious problem of shoplifting. And that's why some stores have actually taken those automated tills out, because they've been losing so much money. And I can only see that as a positive thing, because these are dreadful dystopian apparatus that's creeping more and more into our society.
When they came in, people said, these are never going to catch on. Like, I go there and I declare how much I've taken, and then I decide how much I'm going to pay. But I suppose it relies on the principle that most people are honest. I mean, 95% of people are honest and they're not going to steal. But the 5% that do, it is a huge problem. It's going to lose the supermarkets and the stores that have these self-service machines a lot of problems. But, you know, there was something that happened with some of the supermarkets last week. Two of the biggest supermarket chains, Tesco's and Sainsbury's in the UK, both had a nationwide IT crash, and they were forced to go back and use cash for a day. But the people who were most affected by this were the under 30s, the Generation Z, as you said. Do you think this may have been a bit of a wake-up call to them?
I hope so. I mean, this is something that I talk about with fellow sort of awake people in the, you know, freedom movement, as we might call it, all the time. It's, when are we going to get the younger people waking up? Because there's plenty of people in their 40s, 50s, upwards who are aware of what's going on. But the younger generations have been completely immersed in this digital world. They see it all as progress, as convenience, as comfort, as safety, security, all that sort of thing. But I do hope that they themselves will see something will spark in among these cohorts of younger people coming up. They'll want to break free from the tightening ratchet of the digital world that's being imposed on them. At the moment, there's not much sign of that, is there? But at some point, it will break. And that, for me, can't come soon enough, because the longer we allow the technocrats to create their surveillance system, the harder it will be to escape from it.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you. I mean, I do think there are some people, some young people who have woken up to this and deliberately go out and use cash and take part in Cash Fridays, but it's not enough. But there are encouraging signs. I mean, just quickly, I mean, we're coming to the end of the show soon. I do hear that there has been an uptick in the use of cash in the UK, which is a very positive sign, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. So the amount of cash transactions inevitably plunged in the COVID period because shops were refusing cash, we know, as we've already discussed.
Yeah.
But it since did, then, yeah. it has climbed back up again.
It has gone up, Neil. I'm going to have to stop you, I'm afraid. Sorry, because we're really nearly at the end of the show. I'd love to talk to you more about this, because this is an encouraging sign. We need to use cash more. And we also need to vote for parties like mine, who would make sure that shops are forced to use cash and give that as a service to their customers. Neil, thank you so much for joining me here on today's News Talk, TNT.